No matter what the season or the weather, the insects are all around us. And you know what? They're fascinating creatures. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and recently retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest. And Phil, great to see you again.
Nice to be here.
And it always works better when I turn your microphone on. Now I've got it. Now I've got the microphone on. Well, listen, I tell you what, we've got lots to talk about, and I'll invite our listeners to join in. If you have a question, insect related, give us a call at 800-642-1234. I was out on a farm yesterday. We were actually taking up some hunting tents that have been sitting out there since the turkey season, and I got home, checked for ticks. Didn't find any ticks, and then I was actually reclining on the couch watching a little TV and looked at my arm, and here was a tick. And it was a wood tick, so I wasn't all that concerned, but I thought I had looked pretty carefully, I even missed a wood tick, which is a pretty good-sized tick.
You know, I think one of the problems sometimes is they're in the seams of clothing and whatnot, and they just wander around. I mean, it's quite common. You know, you go camping, you bring the tent home, you throw it in the corner, and 2 days later you see a tick sitting there waiting for you. And so it isn't that unusual, and it does. I mean, the big thing at this time of the year is that the smaller stage of the deer tick, the nymphal stage, is out and active, harder to see, and it is the more likely culprit to transmit Lyme and some of these other diseases. So that's why people have to keep their guard up, is if you're out in the woods where there tends to be ticks, you know, we tell people anytime there's no snow on the ground, you should take personal protection and do a tick check when you come in from outside.
So what do they look like, these nymphs?
They're the size of a small sesame seed. You know, so they're pretty small, and you know, most people are used to seeing adult ticks, and you know, they're a little easier to pick up. And that's the interesting thing, is it's more likely that the adult ticks are removed before they get the opportunity to transmit, whereas these nymphs, being smaller, are more easily overlooked. And that's why we know that they are more likely to transmit these diseases, even though technically the percentage of ticks in the population that carry the disease in the nymphal stage is less. It's half of what it is in the adults. And so,
if
you get a small tick on you at this time of the year, you assume that it's probably a deer tick. And, you know, we tell people 36 to 48 hours. So if you had not been in the woods and you were in the woods late yesterday afternoon and you found the tick this morning, the probability is that it wasn't there long enough to cause problems. But if you have this longer exposure, then it's best to talk to your family physician, because of the high incidence of Lyme disease, one of the things that CDC is suggesting is if you know it's a deer tick, it was there long enough, they will give you a 1 day's antibiotic as a prophylactic treatment. Mm-hmm. So as I said, we're definitely in that range with at least the last figures I saw, approximately 40% of the adults and 20% of the nymphs carrying Lyme disease in the state.
Mm. And you mentioned something about care, I mean, or avoiding. How do you avoid
Well, you know, they always talk about trying to be as much skin covered up as you can. But to me, you know, when you look at the options, there is a clothing treatment that contains permethrin. Although when you buy the product, it says it's a tick repellent. It really isn't. It's a tick killer and not registered for your skin. So, you know, if you have a pair of khakis that you wear or a pair of Carhartts, you spray that, and any tick that walks on it will die before it has any opportunity. Yeah. So as I said, it's good to cover up even in a warm day to protect yourself, but having this treated clothing, and you can even buy in some of the sporting goods stores clothing that has this stuff impregnated in it and will go through like 40 washings. And aside from helping to keep the mosquitoes away, as I said, it gives you this added protection that any ticks that come into contact, it will not have the opportunity to make you sick.
Stephen Hudson contacted us and said he follows the CDC recommendations to throw clothes in a dryer on high heat for an hour as soon as they get home to get rid of the ticks.
Yeah, no, definitely. They are very sensitive to desiccation and the kind of heat. You know, we've talked about that treatment for bed bugs and on articles, too, that can tolerate that kind of heat. And insects have no way of cooling themselves, and same with ticks. And so that's why those kind of heatings tend to cause high mortality.
Mm. Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, our guest today. If you have a question for him, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. You know, and Paul and Madison, we'll get to you in just a second here, but there's a couple of other things I wanted to bring up. One is a mosquito virus that is out there that we...
Yeah. So, I mean, this has been anticipated. The virus is chikungunya, and it has not been found to be transmitted in the United States until I saw the announcement last week. And it makes people quite ill, very serious, you know, joint pains and the like. It's similar to dengue. And so there have been a number of people who have traveled outside this country that have contracted the disease and brought it here. But for the first time, they've announced that they have seen some transmission in people that had no travel history. So we know that the mosquitoes are picking it. So part of the story is that the mosquitoes need to pick it up from somebody that's already infected. So the higher percentage of people that we have that carry it in their blood gives the mosquito the opportunity to do this. Now, the good news to us in Wisconsin is that there's only two species that have been implicated, the Asian tiger mosquito and Aedes aegypti, which is a real stinker of mosquito, and neither of them are found in the state.
Okay.
So we are not aware of. Now, the question is, could there be other competent vectors? Research hasn't shown us any yet. I won't say it's impossible, but not very likely. But Asian tiger mosquito is very well established in the southeast United States. And so, as I said, this kind of comes on the radar screen and just kind of like West Nile, another issue that we're going to have to deal with in the future.
We have up on my Facebook page, Judith put up a photo of another insect, the red lily leaf beetle.
Right. So this
setting
one.
Some state records.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that I found just, I won't say inspiring, but interesting in my career is all the new things that came in. So, you know, I'm officially retired, so this one's not my fault. But PJ Leash, who now is running the diagnostic lab, there was an intercept of some leaf beetle larvae. And PJ requested specimens, reared them out, and it turns out it's our first record of this insect. It's a European insect that has been found in the East Coast in Ontario. It attacks lilies, as the name implies. The adult reminds me a lot of an asparagus beetle. It's just a different color form with that bright red body and like
bright
the general,
red, yeah.
General shape is the same as the asparagus beetles that people run into. So, you know, not surprising. Again, it was a person that saw something odd on their plants that were good enough to get a hold of us and send samples in so that we could verify that now, indeed, we have one more little visitor.
And
here.
Where are they in the state? Are they?
Well, those were picked up in the central part of the state. But because this often comes in on imported plant material, that's the most likely source.
Sure.
And so we got a hold of the Department of Ag, and, you know, they do nursery inspections and the like. It'll be interesting to see. You know, it's not a devastating type of insect. It's just that, again, if you've got water lilies now, we got one more little critter that they're going to have to deal with.
And we don't know how to, are there ways to eliminate them? Or probably.
Yeah. I mean, there's even some organic sprays that can be used to knock them down. You know, the plants will tolerate the feeding. Insect feeding most of the time is more cosmetic. But again, if you're growing plants for ornamental purposes, you want them to look nice. And so, as I said, there will be some things that can be applied but you got to be a little more careful here because some of our insecticides are quite toxic to fish. So what might be appropriate for roses will not be appropriate if you got a fish pond and lilies type of thing. So, you know, we always preach about reading the label, and this is one of the reasons why is if a product is particularly toxic to fish, it will be very clear on the label and would not be used in that purpose.
Paul in Madison, thanks a lot for waiting. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This summer, as I've been mowing the lawn, as I brush past bushes and the leaves of trees and whatnot, clouds and clouds of, I assume, plant juice-sucking insects just explode into the air. And I'm wondering, is this, are they the male side of the mosquitoes? Is it a mixture? And is it cloudier, so to speak, this summer because of all the rain?
Would have to see the critters. My first take, if I had to take a wild guess, is they're more likely something like lake flies, which look very similar to mosquitoes. And in the scheme of flies are rather closely related, but they don't bite. And lake flies, like mosquitoes, are pretty wimpy flyers. So you will get times that they will sit down in the shrubbery and lay low during the day and then do most of their flying at night. So are you relatively close to a body of water?
I live about 2 blocks from Lake Mendota.
Ah, okay. I'm pretty comfortable saying they're lake flies. So.
Okay, because they're green in color, and they're much, much smaller than the female mosquito.
Yeah, no, then definitely. And I mean, there is a couple hundred species of lake flies, but we do get that little green devil that comes off. And it's interesting. I used to get specimens. They're small enough to get through some screening. So people would find all these little critters on their windowsills and whatnot and wonder what's up. And as I said, you were getting lake flies that were drawn in by the lights at night. Very short-lived as individuals, but you can get times of a couple weeks where they're just tremendous. And, of course, Lake Winnebago has a much larger lake fly that's infamous for having incredible emergences at certain times of the year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Pedro in Aurora, Illinois, you're next. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Actually, my question is, I've heard that if you spray for mosquitoes, mosquitoes only have a span of where they travel within 20 yards of their berth. Is that correct?
It depends on the kind of mosquito, and if they were all that poor of flyers, life would be good. what we tend to see in most of the Midwest is when mosquitoes just get to the point of bringing tears to your eyes, those are usually floodwater mosquitoes, and they go 20 miles from their breeding site.
Okay.
So, you know, it's appropriate that if you're having a, you know, a picnic or a celebration in the backyard, you spray, you knock down what's hiding there, but you realize in a couple of days they will come back in. And again, so it's a very temporary fix. You can't get to the breeding site because it's so far away. But that's what the challenge is, too, is that no matter what you do on your property or your neighbors do, often the source of the mosquitoes is going to be a place that you've got no control over.
Hmm. Is there a better time to spray, the evening, morning, or afternoon?
Typically, the best time is really when the mosquitoes start to be most active. So right at dusk or right at dawn is this dawn is the second choice. You've got better control of the spray. The wind speeds are down, so you can tend to push it into where you're seeing the most activity. They're up and about and you're easy to get to them. So if you had to pick now, you know, if it's a 20 mile an hour wind at dusk, don't bother. You know, that should be sufficient to keep them down. But as I said, typically the conditions are best done at the time when we see the mosquito activity. It's interesting for mosquitoes. Oftentimes, by the time you get to midnight or 1 o'clock, they're less active than they were at 9 o'clock when the sun goes down.
Thanks a lot.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Ann in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Look, I have a two questions. One is on box elder bugs. I didn't have any box elder bugs this spring, and I did spray last fall, which was the first time I've done that, and usually in spring when they wake up, they're everywhere. And I'm just wondering, if was it because of the spring, or maybe was it because of the winter that we had?
Yeah, I don't think the winter, you know, that's a native insect, so it's put up with kind of hostile conditions for a long time. I mean, the two things in general, the numbers of box elder bugs were not near as high last year as the previous year. That relates a little bit to how the summer droughts come in. But it could just be that you knocked most of that overwintering population out. It's been a very wet spring in early summer. That's not good for them. They tend to get a mold disease and die. Although I have seen baby box elder bugs out, you know, if I get in the right spot. But as I said, it sounds like your timing was right. And definitely if you shut the door in the fall, you would not expect them in the spring.
Well, that's great. And is there an inverse relationship between the number of box elder bugs and centipedes? Because it seems like I didn't have any centipedes, and I usually do, and I just didn't know if they were related.
No, although centipedes will feed on box elder bugs. They're generalists. They feed on all kinds of things. So I've never seen that relationship. As I said, the normal relationship is a very dry late summer means all kinds of box elder bugs. Although I will tell you about 4 years ago, I was absolutely blown away because it was a particularly wet late summer and I wasn't expecting any box elder bugs and I was wrong.
Okay. And my other question I wanted to ask is about bugs in sunflower seeds. Two summers ago, I had an infestation in my attached garage of moths in sunflower seeds that were in a garbage can. And I thought it was completely closed, but I realized it wasn't airtight in the corners, and that seemed to disappear because I kind of shooed all the moths away and let them escape. But then the next spring, they came back really bad, and then I had all these little moths in my house, and some were flying and some were resting on the walls, and they seemed to like being on white or light surfaces. And I was trying to identify them, and they looked like Indian meal moths. They were dark gray with a lighter horizontal band, and some looked like clothes moths, the beige ones. And I was just wondering, how did that happen that they ended up going in my house from the garage? And I haven't seen them now. Are they, and, you know, all those bad seeds are gone, and I've learned to seal my seeds in plastic bags. Is the problem really resolved now, or?
I would think so. Now, I don't think that the golden ones were likely clothes moths. They're quite a bit smaller. There is an angamoid grain moth that's also associated with seeds that it could have been. So there's about four or five stored product moths, but by far the Indian meal moth is the most common. And so it is common in pet food, but all it takes is one female to get into the cupboard and lay her eggs on noodles, nut meats, raisins, anything that's dried plant material, potpourri. And so it's not quite that unusual to get something that starts the fire one place and then it goes elsewhere. But once you go through the cleanup and either throw out what's infested, and then you protect things that are susceptible in appropriate containers that they can't get to, within a 2 or 3 weeks, it stops. If it doesn't stop, then there's always something. And this is what gets frustrating for all of us is, what else did they find? You know, and it can be Christmas wreaths with walnuts or, you know, any natural plant product. And it sometimes is just maddening because, as I said, you've gotten 98% of it taken care of, but that 2% that you've overlooked that may not be obvious can continue to generate moths as long as they've got a food source. And so, as I said, it but definitely what I tell people, you go through the cleanup, it should be remarkably better within 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. If it's not remarkably better, as I said, then you have overlooked something and you have to keep on searching. And, you know, items that you go through very quickly, you know, a breakfast cereal that 2 weeks the box is empty, that's not the concern. It's usually long-term storage. But tea leaves, as I said, when you really sit down and think of all the dried plant material we have, it's not always food in particular, like the potpourri. So when people used to call me up and say, I see meal moths in my bathroom. Well, you don't have food in your bathroom. But again, indeed, you might have some you know, flower petals in a sachet or something like that, and they definitely will take care of that, as they will hot peppers. I know people used to be amazed. They bring in hanging hot dried peppers, and be darned, the Indian meal moths were more than happy to take advantage of those.
Ann, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist. And I'm telling you what, we're getting lots of good questions about the bugs that are bugging you maybe, or that you have questions about. Give us a call if you still haven't been had your question answered. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Diane sent us on my Facebook page a wonderful photo. I'm sorry, Diane and Friendship. This beautiful spider on the clothesline. And it's a green and some white stripes on it. Really is pretty.
Typically, when you see these unbelievable colored spiders with pinks and other, they turn out to be crab spiders. I can tell from the general body form it's not. I'm guessing this is one of the orb web weaver spiders, just from the body shape. The only way I could verify that is to get a real close up of the face and look at how the eyes sit. But the general bulbous abdomen, and I'm not used to seeing green. I'm used to seeing lots of yellows and reds and other bright colors there. But I bet you this is an orb weaver spider of one sort or another.
It really is really quite pretty, to be perfectly honest. All right, we have Mike in Summit Lake with a question for you next. And let me get him up here. Mike, hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I've got something is chewing on my radishes, the root part, underground. And I'm not sure if that's a cutworm damage. They just seem to run all over the outside of them. And
I'm guessing there is a little maggot called the cabbage maggot that gets into all kinds of things in the crucifer family. And it's notorious because you'll see the trails and the gouges, but you often don't see the larvae. Whereas if it was something like wireworm, more likely the culprit would still be there. And so cabbage maggot goes through at least three generations, but by far the most serious is the spring one that attacks about the time that lilacs are in full bloom. And so that's when you often have to protect your plants for the next 3 or 4 weeks, and there are various products. One of the interesting ones, and it has an organic label, is a product called spinosad, And spinosad, which is sold under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew and Monterey's, you know, vegetable spray, has effectiveness. You spray it on the ground level when you expect the flies to be out there, and you basically shut the door. Unfortunately, once they lay their eggs and the maggots are in the root, you can't rescue it. So it's kind of a, you know, a preventative type treatment. But that would be something to look for in the future to prevent it. And again, one of the things with radish crops, it's often later season you see less activity, although it's still possible.
I see. Okay.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks, Mike. Thank you for calling. And we have Tony in Sheboygan next with a question. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have serious allergies to most stinging insects, bees, wasps, hornets. To try to make my yard less friendly to them, I've removed all flowering plants. I never have food out in my backyard, keep the garbage covered. I'm still seeing these insects flying in my backyard. I'm seeing a couple of hives. Two questions. The first is, I don't really like the idea of wasp traps, but I'm kind of desperate. But if I would put out a wasp trap, would that only serve to draw more to my yard? And also, is there anything I can do to discourage these kinds of insects from coming into my yard and nesting in my yard?
Well, the thing about wasp traps, it really only catches a certain group of scavenger wasps, like the yellow jackets. And so I don't see an advantage. It just isn't going to give you the results that you want. I think one of the things you may consider, because you've got paper wasps and Polistes wasps and all these other things, so you've done a lot of adjustments that should help. But it may be, since almost all the wasp species that we have that live in colonies, and those are the ones that tend to be the most aggressive, start their colonies in the spring and then build as the summer goes on. So it may be appropriate, if you can get some help from somebody, is when you see some of these nests early, is to basically deal with them, you know, treat them, knock them out, and in this case, kill the queen so that you don't have any more proliferation. I don't know of any repellents at work. You know, I could tease you and say make your backyard a sandbox, but, you know, so you're making it a very hostile, you know, environment that there's nothing that they would like. But as I said, I think you've already made some good adjustments. But, you know, the other point, again, you know, the ones that go after food are most likely to sting you, and the ones that live in the nest, whether it's the ground or above ground nest, are the ones that are most active. The other species of wasps that you run into that we'd call solitary wasps, so they don't have a true nest, really are very docile, you know, you don't have much of a risk with them, unless, you know, unfortunately you put your hand down and one's there type of thing. It's got to be that kind of close contact. Whereas the problem with these scavenger ones that go after food, you put anything out, they're already there, and they're usually moderately aggressive at defending things. And so, as I said, I think the one thing you might consider is in the spring of the year, when you identify a spot that you think you've got a nest building or something, is get somebody to treat it for you to reduce the local populations.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Tony. Thank you for calling. Tell you what, if you're on your computer, I hope you'll go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, because we have couple of photos and a question from Ryan from La Crosse, who said, we had a mayfly hatch last night off the Mississippi, and I've never seen anything like it. And there's like feet of of mayflies here. I was told it means the river is healthy when you have that kind of a hatch.
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of things, even black flies, you know, the curse of if you're a canoeist or whatnot, they do better in cleaner water. You know, and it in general. So you can make that speculation. You know, they do ebb and flow. I in fact remember reading 3 or 4 weeks ago that there was a crew from South America coming up here trying to time this, because again, if you get the right time and at the right place, it's like a science fiction movie, and that's what those pictures look like. I mean, it's just
unbelievable.
You know, and I'm sure these are close to the water source, and you need, you know, still nights so that they fly well and the like. But the sheer biomass, as I said, is staggering, but you take back it. It is a sign that the water is cleaner, because mayflies like clean water, as do stoneflies, and a lot of things that people that fish trout are very fond of are good indicators of clean water.
I can remember driving across a bridge on the Wisconsin River at night during a hatch like that, and there had to be 6 inches.
And they bring the snowplows out at times because, you know, all those crushed mayflies do make the roads kind of slippery. And so there is a physical thing and the like, but it's an interesting phenomenon. And
sure.
So they said, in fact, it's interesting because my next door neighbor wanted to go and see it. And I said, you know, I know it's in July, but you can't quite predict it. So I'll have to pass on to him that it's happening now if he wants to go up there and take a look.
Aaron and Dousman up next. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a beetle. It's actually quite pretty to look at, but it's eating all the leaves of plants in the vegetable garden and bushes around the house. It's almost like an iridescent copper shell with a greenish head.
Japanese beetle.
Mm-hmm.
The bug.
That is a Japanese beetle.
That is the Japanese beetle. Yeah. So where are you located?
In Dousman.
Okay, so this is the first time you've seen it?
You know, we always had the ones that looked like ladybugs that I thought were Japanese beetles.
Yeah, and those are Asian lady beetles, so that's where the confusion comes. Those are the ones that come in your house, yeah. So it's interesting. So in Madison, in my west side neighborhood, we're about 20 years into the Japanese beetle plague. And the good news is, you know, I'll go out in the backyard, and if I really hunt, I can find one here, one there. But when it first got started, it was buckets. And so that's been kind of the pattern you tend to see, that when they get into an area, they really get crazy. And one of the things that they're so famous for is the wide diversity of plants they feed on, you know, raspberries, grapes, linden trees, birch trees, rose bushes. And the unpleasant thing is that they're out for 2 months and they're flying in from down the road. So you've got no control over it. But over time, it will get better. But why I had asked if this is a relatively new phenomenon for you, unfortunately, it's going to be a tough 5-6 years of activity would be my guess. And plenty of products that can be used, but the dilemma there is they last for a few days, and because these fly for a couple months, it's a major, unlike anything you probably have ever dealt with as a gardener, as far as is the kind of problems this thing creates when you have high numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I have a lot of dogs, so I don't use any chemical sprays or anything.
Yeah, well, we would tell you.
Do you much good anyway.
Yeah, don't buy the traps. They make it worse, not better. You know, it's there are some physical things. I mean, some people will use, you know, floating row covers to protect their raspberries and the like. You know, there are some organic products, you know, neem oil and the like that work to some degree. But as I said, as far as finding an answer that's going to make your life better with this one, there really isn't one.
There you go.
That's good to know.
Yep, thanks, Aaron. Thank you for calling. Go back to that mayfly hatch for a minute. Somebody was wondering, would a hatch like that show up on radar?
Yes. I mean, if it's high enough and the conditions are right, it again, it's such a dense cloud that you do pick up mayfly hatches, and it would not surprise me at one bit.
Dennis in Glendale has a question for you. Hi, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I was up on my property on Washington Island, and I disturbed an insect that I'm trying to identify. But I think it might be a cicada, but when it flew off, it was dark and fast and made a screaming sound like a bottle rocket. And I was looking at my Kaufman Field Guide insects in North America, and my guess is a cicada, but which one, or are you familiar
mm-hmm.
with it?
I'm a, you know, normally cicadas, you know, make their noise when they're stationary, not flying. Now, what I would suggest is to go to the University of Michigan, do cicadas in Michigan, and they have a website that has both pictures and the calls of all the species. And, you know, there's more than one species. Most of us identify the dog day cicada, but in Wisconsin, we have at least 5 or 6 other species that you could run into. So that would be a way of just seeing if something looked like it, something sounded like it. Then if not, I don't know. I mean, there are some beetles that make some interesting noises when they move. That would be the next possibility. I would think, especially some of the longhorn beetles, they stridulate or they rub things together. But the screaming side, as I said, I think you can get a pretty good look, because we're dealing with a relatively limited number of species of cicadas to deal with, and see if that fits the pattern or not.
So University of Michigan.
Michigan and do cicadas. And as I said, they have a website that has the North American species, pictures of them, and then they also have little sound clips so that you can see. Because, you know, there's a number of interesting species in places outside of Wisconsin, the scissor grinder cicada and whatnot that, you know, some people identify when you grow up as kids. You know, you hear all these weird sounds and come to places, and we all don't have the same cicadas, so the calling is quite different.
Well, I'm 71 years old, and I've never seen anything like it.
Well, you learn something new every single day, Dennis. Thank you a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Here's something Sue in Milltown discovered. She said she's discovered that baby powder is an excellent mosquito repellent. Have you ever heard of that?
It would be interesting to know if, you know, some of the odors and whatnot associated with it may have the repellency more than the powder itself. Because, you know, there's lots of natural products that have some repellency to mosquitoes. The question is, does it last long enough and the like? And that's why, indeed, yeah, you know, they have not, you know. And now if you look at the mosquito, you know, it's interesting to me. 10 years ago, you could basically get DEET and that was it. But now we have, you know, oil of eucalyptus and lemon oil and other natural products that have efficacy as mosquito repellents. The difference between products is often how long they last. Is it 20 minutes versus a couple hours and the like? So as I said, I just wonder if there are some chemicals that give baby powder its fresh smell that may indeed have some repellency to the mosquitoes would be my first guess.
Fred in Adams County, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning, folks. I want to tell you, I took some people down to Amtrak of Wisconsin Dells to get on the Empire Builder just before the train come rolling in. It was about noon a week ago today. A big black hornet flew out, and before that cold front hit, I had my shorts on, and he hit me in the calf of my leg. And I'll tell you, I was never allergic to any oak, poison ivy, poison sumac. I've been out in the woods a lot, but he hit me. My leg was swelled up for 3 days, and now I'm feeling better, but I got a hole in my leg where he hit me.
Wow.
Okay. Well, you know, my first guess is being big in dark, it could be a cricket hunter or one of the other solitary wasps, which are normally not that likely to sting, but if they do, I mean, the way you look at this is the venom that they have in when they sting their prey paralyzes it, in some cases cause tissue damage. And so if they get enough of this venom in you, you do expect a localized reaction. So as I said, it's unfortunate you had that experience because it's not real common. But I could definitely see if one of them did get the opportunity to sting you that you could have a pretty dramatic reaction.
Yeah, I got a hole in my leg. But you know what? I blame it on Amtrak and Empire Builder. I'm kidding. It's just before the train come in, he nailed me, and I'm okay now. But it's just one of those things. I mean, watch out for these big black hornets. He was a black one.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well. Yeah.
Well, you know, and some of those critters, we're approaching 2.5 inches. So you figure if it's going to sting you, it's just like the cicada killers, which are not very likely to sting. But I never would want to get the experience type of thing because they're big enough. It's got to hurt.
I'm just happy just hearing what happened to Fred. I don't need firsthand experience either. Thanks, Fred. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Dan and Neshota a chance to join us too. So let's go there. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. I've lived in Neshota for 20 years, and I sit up on my driveway a lot. And in the last year, I've noticed this green beetle that sits out in the sun in a driveway, and he stands upright at maybe a 45-degree angle. I mean, they're lightning fast. And as soon as a little insect goes by, an ant or something, he's on top of it. He chases it down and attacks it. I've never seen him before. And I just wonder if your guest knows what that is. I've tried to ask several people, and nobody seems to know.
I think it's a tiger beetle.
Tiger beetle.
Tiger beetles are incredibly green metallic.
Yeah.
They're a very visual creature because they have to basically chase their prey down. Okay. And if you do a search on Wisconsin tiger beetles, there is an exquisite sight. Okay. That has the pictures of all the species and the like. And they're really neat creatures. It was also a creature that was mistaken for emerald ash borer because it is so bright green colored, but much quicker, and just their behavior is totally different. But I said, with it being a predator like that and that color, it is a species, one of the species of tiger beetles, I'm pretty sure.
I didn't know that the beetles would go after other insects like ants or anything like that.
Depends on the family.
Apart.
We do have some predaceous beetles. It comes from a general group, the ground beetles, carabids, that are all good guys, So
there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We had a Facebook question from Jackie. Could you talk about the life cycle of the potato beetle? I've heard it can be difficult to eradicate them from a garden plot once you have them.
Okay, so the Colorado potato beetle typically goes through two generations a year in Wisconsin, overwinters as adults. Feeds on plants in the solanaceous family. So aside from potatoes, eggplant can get hit. Once in a while, even tomato, they feed on nightshade. So that's one of the problems. There is lots more plants out there than just people's potatoes. When they get into an area, when they first wake up in the spring, everything is kind of on the same time frame. One of the things that makes them difficult to control later in the season is that we've got them in all life stages, eggs, larvae on the plants, larvae that burrow in the ground to transform into adults and adults. And so we often talk about early treatments often put the fire out very easily, whereas you get later in the season, one treatment never will work because there's not all life stages that are susceptible in front of you at one time. And so that's what makes them difficult. And again, I go back in my experience as a graduate student way back in the late 60s, early 70s, we didn't have a lot of Colorado potato beetles around. But once they move into an area, they arrived, they wouldn't go away. There's an interesting question of what happened to them for 30 or 40 years, because as I said, it's a native insect. We've always had potatoes. It's a big commercial crop in this state. But they really did seem to go through this big long-term lull. But to me, there was a buildup from the mid-70s on. And then the other complicating factor is that they develop resistance to many of the pesticides that have been used. The old classic, when I was a young graduate student, was 7. That worked great. Now it's worthless for most populations. So that also complicates it. Is you got to keep up on what products are working, and your timing's got to be right. And again, even if you do everything right, there's no guarantee that next year they won't come in again, and you're going to have to put up the battle again.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, retired Extension entomologist, but he doesn't sound like he's retired, does he? He's working pretty hard today, answering your questions here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, Phil Pelletieri with us, talking about the world of insects. And Phil, on our Facebook page, we have a most interesting moth, I think.
Yes, and so this has got a very interesting story. The animal's called a black witch, and what is hard to appreciate from the picture, other than it's a gorgeous animal, is it has a wingspan of upwards of 5 to 6 inches. It's a very large moth, and it's not native. In fact, it's typically considered a Mexican, in parts of Texas, a little bit of breeding, but on occasion, they blow up here in storm fronts. And so it's interesting, early in my career, before we had digital cameras and whatnot, once in a great while somebody would send one in. But once we got to this point that people could take pictures of these, it turns out that just about every year I'd get 2 or 3 pictures from some place in the state where a black witch had come in. And this particular specimen is very fresh. The scales are not rubbed off. The wings are not
really
battered.
Pretty.
So you know that it was recently emerged. And again, it must have caught the right wind front and shown up here. And that's a real trophy. If you told me to go look for one, I could be out there for years searching and not find one. But if you get lucky enough one to show up, it really is quite the treasure.
Stuart in DeForest has a question for you. Hi, Stuart.
Good morning. A couple quick questions.
Sure.
One is about Japanese beetles. I've been treating a linden tree for the last few years for Japanese beetles with that Bayer product, and it's done a great job. But my question is, a few years ago, there was when it blooms out, I don't know what kind of butterfly it is, but it has the same coloring as a monarch, and they're smaller. But that tree was loaded with those butterflies. I was wondering, does that Bayer product affect other insects?
It's not a black and white kind of question. So in general, the rule is the chemical does not move very well into reproductive tissue, flowers, fruit, and the like. And for that reason, it has a registration for products such as raspberries and some fruit and vegetable crops use it for that. But as typical in nature, you can't make that as an exclusive comment that it works all the time. There are some plants that do move it quite well. In particular, interesting enough, azaleas for whatever reason. Now, to me, the argument in Wisconsin, there's nothing on azaleas that's that bad. You've got to use a Bayer product in most cases. And plus, it's flowering early enough that there's the critters that would be susceptible. But it's a valid question to ask. There have been a couple. In fact, it's one of these things, when it happened a couple years ago, it was a tragedy, and it happened again this year, and you kind of say, why? Where people use that product as a contact spray, not a systemic, and then it really is quite, and so they've had these big bee kills in the state of Washington, and it is a major misuse of the pesticide. You don't spray blooming plants with anything because of pollinator protection. So, so if you were to ask me about treating ash trees, in what is susceptible. There isn't a whole lot susceptible. There isn't a whole lot that goes to ash flowers. It's a wind-pollinated plant. Lindens, it gets a little trickier because lindens are highly attractive to bees and the like. And but if you follow label directions in EPA right now is carefully looking at this question. If there continues to be problems, I assume what we're going to see is some adjustments. But again, what complicates the story is when you've got 300 different kinds of plants, you've got different responses, and people have to study a wide enough breadth of this to get a good picture of it. So in general, some people have implicated these products as being the major cause of colony collapse disorder. It's definitely a product you do not want to expose bees to because it will have an effect. But you cannot automatically assume that when you use a systemic that the bees are getting it through the flowers, because it doesn't work that way chemically. So, generally, I'm not too concerned. But if I had a neighborhood, a bunch of bees, and I had a linden tree, I think I might have a second thought about putting that much exposure, and definitely being careful. I think one of the things that would be a concern is very large trees are hard to get enough chemical in, and so people tend to misuse the product, and the more chemical you're putting in, the more likely you are to have these non-target effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had the one I have is a pretty good-sized trunk, so I have to put like almost a whole gallon of it, actual solution with water in there. So
yeah, I mean, really, the way it's killing the Japanese beetles is more as a stomach poison. They're feeding on it, and that's how it. So it's not a contact kill. So if a butterfly lands on the leaf, not a problem. If the butterfly feeds on the nectar, it shouldn't be a problem, but there probably is some low levels there. And as I said, that's kind of where this question comes in. And it's going through the review process nationally right now. And as I said, one wouldn't be surprised to see some label adjustments in the next year or two.
Yeah. Okay. Can I ask you one other quick question? Last summer, I was on my deck, and there was this wasp on my screen attacking my screen on my deck. And it was not... Normally they have a yellow color to them. This thing had orange coloring, and the thing was about 2.5 to 3 inches long, and it kind of reminded me of those killer wasps in Japan when I've seen shows on. Do you know what that might be?
Okay, so normally when people tell me big, scary-looking, I think cicada killers, but with as much orange as you said rather than yellow, again, there are a number of solitary wasps, some of the cricket hunters. There's one called a golden digger wasp. I would look that one up. Many of these are take katydids and crickets and large grasshoppers as their prey, and then we put burrows in the ground. So that would be my guess, because the golden digger wasp would be very orange in color for most of its body and very large.
I'm not sure if it's off to look it up.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot, Stuart, for calling. And Bill in Lac des Flambeaux, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I've got a question on. I put a number of tomato plants in pots this year and some also in the garden. In the last 3, 4, 5 days, I've been getting these green leaf hoppers, and there are just many of them. As you go to water the root system, they're jumping all over. They're probably not much longer than a quarter inch.
Mm-hmm.
The head, maybe the head of a pencil or a pen, that's... It's kind of a wedge-shaped critter.
Well, it turns out that although we've got lots of different leafhoppers in the state, I don't normally think of tomatoes being susceptible to leafhopper feeding. There's other plants like strawberries that are. And I will tell you that the most serious pest leafhopper we have in the state, the potato leafhopper, is not having a good year. The numbers seem to be down. And so it may just be, you know, oftentimes when you're mowing the lawn, you kick lots of little leafhoppers out and the like. And as I said, when you think about leafhoppers that are capable of causing us crop damage and the like, the potato leafhopper and the aster leafhopper are the two I worry about the most. And as I said, typically on tomatoes, they're not a factor. So probably nothing you're going to have to worry about as far as how the plants perform.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone talking about hoppers, somebody had called in about grasshoppers. Seems to be a lot of grasshoppers this year.
Well, it depends where you're located. You know, most of the grasshoppers we have spend the winter as eggs, hatch in the spring, and the dynamic seems to be wet springs drowned them and they don't have a good year. Dry springs tend to make better survival. But this is soil related. People that have well-draining soils and, you know, lots of sand or some of the gravelly knolls that we have associated with the glacial deposits often have more grasshoppers. I have not seen many, although when I was up in Canada, I was somewhat surprised in that we were on a little island and poking around and be darned. There were grasshoppers all over there in full adults already.
Oh.
Now, it turns out that there are some species like the post-oak grasshopper that can overwinter as adults. So, that, you know, my comment about adults being late and whatnot doesn't fit for all of them. But generally speaking, the areas I've been poking around in the state, it's been wet enough. I have not seen, but I don't usually make my grasshopper predictions until I get into August, because that's when I start seeing the adults. That's when they're more mobile. That's when they can come flying into your backyard and start feeding on things, including plastic screens and paint. And grasshoppers do some pretty strange things at times.
Thomas in Manitowoc joins us next. Hi, Thomas. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I always love to listen to you, Phil. Two questions. One, could you tell me about flea beetles, their life cycle, what they like as far as wet and dry conditions? And the other one is, you were talking about insects that have a resistance to the sprays, and I was just wondering, like in the case of antibiotics, where you have a limited amount of them available and a lot of things are resistant to them, will that ever happen with insecticides, or are they able to keep coming up with an infinite number of insecticide sprays?
No, we're in the same dilemma that the people in antibiotics and diseases are, is that although people do come up with new and try to develop new products, no matter what you come up with, if you push hard enough, the insects will build resistance in their populations. It's a selection pressure type of thing that comes up. And so, you know, a lot of what people are trying to do is rotate products and you know, do a lot of the same things. You only use the products when you need them in order for the product to last longer. Now, we're somewhat blessed in Wisconsin because our winter takes so many things out, and so it we don't push things near as much here, so we have less resistance issues than the people in Florida and the tropics where the insects never stop. So but that being said, whether we get stuff shipped up here that's already resistant, or in the case of Colorado potato beetle, that critter is dynamic enough that it does seem to find a way around whatever we throw at it, you know, given some time. So, as I said, a lot of the same principles are used to try to manage insecticides. Now, the flea beetle story, what complicates it is that technically there are numerous species of flea beetles. You know, there's ones on potatoes, there's one on crucifers, you know, the red-headed flea beetle, there's all kinds of things. But as a general life cycle, most overwinter as adults. And what I tend to find is if we've got good snow cover, look out the next spring, because they survive so well, and they're often one of the first insects to wake up and attack plants. If we have a very open winter, maybe a lot of icing and the like, it may be the opposite. The other thing that it hurts is a lot of them also feed on weeds. And so we find that the more weedy areas adjacent to gardens, the higher flea beetle populations, then they spill over. When I think of things, even though some can go through more than one generation a year, I think of flea beetles as a spring insect. I mean, typically that's when I see the most pressure and things tend to lessen up, which is typically what happens when the good guys catch up with things. We see the same thing with aphids. Said you're always leery in the spring, and if you've got particularly susceptible plants, you know, again, the first broccoli plants that go out, you got to watch it. And there's differences in individual plants. Some of the Chinese cabbage, for whatever reason, are more susceptible to flea beetles than some of the other things like cauliflower and the like. And so for people who've had that experience, as I said, you got to be pretty aggressive early. But much like the Colorado potato beetle story, if you're killing the adults before they lay eggs, you got a much better chance of winning than once we go. What's interesting, the larvae of many flea beetles are root feeding insects and cause very little plant damage. You know, we don't worry about the larvae causing root damage, but we worry about the adults and the feeding that they do.
Yeah. Marcus, you have a quick question for us.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering, the German yellow jackets, are they still as prevalent as they used to be? I haven't seen them around. What's going on? I know they're invasive species.
Yeah, they're in.
Yeah, numbers have been way down the last few years, and one would expect that to continue. You can make the argument they've been here for about 40 years now, and maybe they've come into more of a balance. I know my colleague Bob Jean has speculated that there are some diseases that are a major pressure point going here, but boy, for the longest time you couldn't eat outdoors in September because they'd come and try to steal your food. Now I find at the farmers markets and outdoor restaurants, at least in the Madison area, it is not even a tenth of what it was back in the heyday.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he's going to be with us talking insects right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Phil. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. No matter what the season, we have lots of insects around us, and that's why we have Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, join us every so often to talk about what's going on here in Wisconsin with our insects. And Phil, always great to have you with us. Thank you for coming by.
Nice to be here.
We have lots of callers online, lots of questions. If you have a question about a specific garden pest or maybe just something about wood ticks or nymphs, lots of things that we could talk about with Phil, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Now let's go to Kathy in Clark County next. Kathy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
One first thing about potato beetles. We raise organic potatoes for sale here. And the thing that we found is as soon as the potatoes come up, we really check them over thoroughly underneath the leaves to get those little kind of rust-colored eggs off. And it seems like if we get those off, then we don't have very much problem with them. We do use an organic spray once or twice during the year, Monterey, it's called Garden Spray, and that seems to be real effective. And other than that, just walking through and picking off the occasional beetle and putting it in soapy water seems to be really working well for us.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and that Monterey spray has that spinosad product in it. And, yeah, I mean, timing is everything. You tell people is that you got to be aggressive before they're on your radar screen, really, because, you know, most people won't react until they see the holes in their leaves, and then you're probably too late to catch up with it. But if you know they're coming, you know, as I said, you go out there and put the work in, and you should get the benefits.
But the interesting thing is that we throw a lot of our seed potatoes that we don't use into a compost pile, and sometimes the potatoes will come up in the compost pile. And I've never once seen a potato beetle on those plants.
Interesting.
I can't figure that out.
Mm. Yeah.
But the question that I have is about the gnats this year. Up here in Clark County, we hardly ever have any mosquitoes, and I don't know if that's because of the sandy soil or what, but I don't think I've ever been bitten by a mosquito up here in the last 7 years. But the last 2 years, those little black gnats have been horrible. We can't even work any time of the day in the garden without wearing nets on our heads. And when they bite, they leave sometimes like a big golf ball sized thing on your head or your neck, and you really... The insect repellents hardly help at all, and I was just wondering, you know, anything you could tell me about that.
So because of the biting, it undoubtedly has to be a group that we call black flies. And black flies have to have moving water, creeks, streams, and rivers to breed in. And numerous species, and they do go hot and cold. They're really quite, in some cases, hard to predict. Although, when I think of the worst black fly season, that's typically end of May, first week of June. But I was just up in Canada, and we were in the middle of July, and it was nasty if we got in the wrong spot. And so it does kind of ebb and flow that way. And there are some species that will go through two waves in a year. So they said, you know, I can't even tell you what weather affects it. You know, one argues that the stream is about as stable of environment as it can be, but, you know, some years they're there and some years they're not. But there isn't much one can do. There's such a quick hit and run. Although the interesting thing, you know, being up in Canada, one of the people on the canoe trip with us was from Iowa, and he had a local spray that they used that had some vanilla oil and a couple other interesting products, and it worked amazingly well. Not on mosquitoes, but on black flies. So, you know, they are a different creature. And there are some things out there, but ultimately when they get bad, I have my mesh suit with the mesh hat on it that covers my face. And it's about all you can do. They don't do well when it's real windy. They're not a strong flyer.
Those are black flies. They're so tiny. Sometimes they can almost get through the mesh. Those are black flies.
Well, the other critter that will bite are no-see-ums. And no-see-ums are another gnat. The difference is no-see-ums tend to breed in marshy, pond, swampy, muck type things. And, if you can get any magnification, a black fly, one of the term for them is buffalo gnat. And they have this very swollen thorax on them that is a dead giveaway. So they kind of look humpbacked, would be a way of putting it. Whereas the no-see-ums are just a fragile little tiny fly. I mean, they really isn't a whole lot to speak of that is very distinctive other than they're very small and they bite. And there just isn't small biting gnats other than these no-see-ums, or what some people will call punkies is another common name for them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Kathy. We have Marianne and Poinette with a question for you. Hi, Marianne.
Hello. I have two questions. Are ground bees beneficial?
Well, the paper wasps that live in the ground.
No, these are tiny.
Well, so the question is, a bunch of critters go in one big hole or lots of little holes that there's individuals going in and out of?
Well, I see one hole. I wanted to dig weeds, but I don't want to get stung.
Because there are solitary bees, lots of little holes, each one going in. Those are pollinators, and they do not really aren't aggressive. When you have a bunch of critters that go in the ground in one spot, those are paper wasps that live in the ground, and they look like a bee, but they're technically a wasp.
Oh.
Now, the positive side is they're predators. So they eat caterpillars on your cabbage plants and other things. So it's not as if they're totally a bad critter. The problem is if the nest is disturbed, they are extremely aggressive at defending it. So if whether you dig into it with a shovel or run over it with a lawnmower, it becomes really potentially a very hazardous situation, because you can have hundreds of workers in there that are very agitated and ready to sting. So usually what we try to determine is if it's a place of a lot of pet and people traffic, they probably need to be dealt with. If they are out in the woods somewhere where nobody's going to get close to it, why bother? Type of thing. And what I tend to find that works the best is using a dust, not a spray, and dusting the entrance of the nest at about 8:30, 9 o'clock at night right now, and that should take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you wouldn't try to save them?
No, they're not bees, they're wasps. And as I said, it's just a question of if it's a place that potentially is going to be hazardous, I think they need to be dealt with. Because, again, if somebody accidentally steps into it or other things, somebody's mowing and doesn't know it's there, then there is a potential that they can get a lot of stings.
Well, it's a neglected flower bed that I would like to restore.
Yeah. So, you got one of two options. If you want to work with it this summer, fine. Or you can wait till about the 1st of November, and they will have died out by then, and then you can do whatever you want and not have it, and they don't come back to the same hole. But what we tell people is if you find, you know, an old gopher burrow or whatnot, it's good to fill that in the spring, because if you don't, that potentially is going to be a nest site for them in a given year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a small hole, about the size of my finger.
Yeah. But my guess is underneath it, it's going to be a much larger void space, because, you know, you'll find many times the size of a small softball up to the size of a basketball at times.
There you go, Marianne. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Aaron in Milwaukee has a question for you, Phil. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Kind of a follow-up or question with the deer ticks. I found a deer tick embedded in my skin, and I had to pull it out. I did go to the doctor. She suggested antibiotics, but I didn't want to have, as I think you said 40% might have Lyme disease. Is that right?
Yes.
I didn't want to have antibiotics if I didn't need them. You know, and she did do some testing, and this was within the first week, right? And everything came back negative, although you may know better than I about how good the tests are. And is there something where you then test a little later on to make sure that, you know, you don't have it?
Okay, so there's a couple things going on here. The one treatment that if you catch it within the first 2 or 3 days of the tick being on your person is just a 1 day's treatment of antibiotic. Versus if you contract Lyme disease and show symptoms, then if you start the antibiotic regime, it's often 3 weeks. So that's one of the things you're weighing is small amounts now as a preventative versus a treatment, which is more. Now, the blood test over time gets better because what they're testing for is antibodies in your system that are reacting to. So, yes, a comparative from early to late will give you a better indication if you've got it. And very early, often you have not started to develop the antibodies yet. So, as I said, it does become a personal choice, but I think the reason CDC is going with this is they find that just 1 day's, you know, you tend to have less side effects if you only have to take antibiotics 1 day versus over a long period of time. And so that's what they're looking at.
Yeah, I guess my doctor didn't realize about the 1 day. She wanted to give me a full course of it. And
Well, that might relate to how long she thought your exposure was. If you had the tick on you and you go talk to your doctor a week later, it's too long of a time frame for the 1 day's treatment to be successful.
Okay, and how long should I wait for the second, testing? Then,
well, you could probably just wait until you think you get symptoms, whether the rash or some of the other complications.
Yeah,
if you don't get any symptoms, then, you know, it's probably nothing to worry about.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot, Aaron, for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, I'm one of those that I'd get it taken care of right away if I could.
My poor internist does get a call from Phil every once in a while because even though I preach about doing the tick checks and whatnot, there are some that get past me, especially if they decide to attack a place that's hard to see.
Yeah, understood. Elizabeth in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a number of honeybee hives, and one of them was queenless, and they were making their own queen, which is what they normally do. But while it was weak, it got earwigs. And now it has a queen that's laying, and I'm pretty sure the earwigs are eating the eggs. And so I'm wondering if there is a treatment for earwigs that won't hurt the bees.
I don't know of any.
Oh, there,
you know, maybe worth checking with other beekeepers, but that's walking a very fine line because normally what one would expect that has efficacy against one kind of critter does the other. You know, I know a few other insect groups that we do have some of the bacteria products for killing wax moths or whatnot won't affect the bees, but I don't know anything like that for earwigs, unfortunately.
Okay. I've heard that you can put borax in a sugar water in a container that's lidded and make the hole small enough, and that will get rid of ants in a hive. And I know that borax also will kill earwigs, but I'm just not sure.
Well, it's a stomach poison, so it has to be eaten. And unfortunately, I know of cases of, they were doing this for yellow jackets, where they would put sugar water with borax, and it would kill the yellow jackets. But I would fear that if the bees know it's honey water or sweet water, they may indeed feed on it. So that gets kind of tricky.
The technique I heard was you put it in an enclosed container with a small enough hole that the ant can go in, but not the honeybee. And so I'm wondering, is an earwig small enough that...
No, they're about the size. Yeah, maybe even a little longer. Maybe not quite as thick a body, but they get the same size as a honeybee, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Mike in Dodge County. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question is on deer flies and why deer flies bite and the way they do. It seems like when you come up on you're out in the woods, whatever, they kind of chase you and hound you down. They seem like they're territorial, and they just kind of will hound you, and they kind of always want to land on you and bite you. I kind of figure it's like mosquitoes, maybe, where they need the protein food or something like that, but just wondering if you could kind of tell us a little bit about deer flies.
So deer flies and horse flies belong to a family, and we have, I'm guessing, upwards of 35, 40 species in the state. The maggot stage is a predator in swampy, mucky areas, so that's why somewhere you need a source of water within half a mile or more. The adults are a very visual creature. They find their prey by movement. So the more you move and swat, the more you attract, unfortunately. And their mechanism, unlike a mosquito, which is more kind of like a fine little straw that's used to feed on you, is multiple stab wounds. But it's the females trying to get blood to have a protein source to produce eggs. And so, yeah, it's, you know, a very difficult creature to deal with because, as I said, they're visual, they're faster than heck. Although dragonflies and a few other things do prey upon them, so they've got their own problems. But as far as an easy source, one of the things that people will use, there's a double-sided sticky card called a tread fly deer fly trap that you put on the back of your baseball cap, and when they land, they get caught. One of my favorite pitchers in my career was a gentleman that I had talked to about this, and he took a flower pot and covered it with a very sticky material called Tanglefoot. And his problem was when he's walking his dog in the morning, the deer flies were just driving him crazy, and his dog, unfortunately, too. He must have had 400 deer flies on this cap. So it was very effective. He was very pleased. But it was also quite a fashion statement. If you can think about a black, shiny flower pot on your head walking up and down the street, it probably got the neighbors talking. But as I said, you know, they are attracted. It's interesting that there's color patterns. Deer flies like a kind of a loud blue color. Horse flies like more of a black. So you do find it. But as I said, it as far as, because they're so mobile, because they're so fast, you also notice sometimes when you're driving your car down a lane, you know, to go to the cabin, there's just a flock of these things. Because, again, it's a big, large moving object. That's what draws them in.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Mike. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate your call. We have some questions. An email from Mary from Cedarburg. I was working in my landscape flower gardens and have seen some very bright, tiny, bright red insects. I don't know if they bite or sting, but it is painful and or burns even more than a bee sting. What are these?
A little stumped, because when I think of little, tiny, bright things running around, there are some mites I call velvet mites. They're predators on insect eggs. Some feed on pollen and the like. So you see them in the soil, but I am not aware of them biting. In fact, I wouldn't expect them to bite. Boy, I you know, if you can get one, send it in. It said PJ, I'm sure can give you more. But when I think of small, red, and biting, it doesn't add up to anything right off the top of my head.
And back to potato beetles for a bit. Maggie from Blue River says that she plants potatoes mid-June to the beginning of July to avoid the potato beetles. She says it works for her, great for her, and she gets a really good crop. That's in the Blue River area.
Yeah, you know, normally when I tell people, you expect them to be out there in a normal year, in the first week of June, looking for things. And so some people put a trap crop where they will put something in, to concentrate the beetles and then deal with them in that spot. And in fact, eggplant works quite well for something like that. But you can avoid them if you plant late enough, if you've got a normal year. You know, the one thing I think that I learned in my 40 years of chasing bugs is when you get these wild years that are excessively hot or excessively cold, you got to ignore the calendar.
Yeah.
So in particular there, what I would worry about is if it's a particularly cool year and things are delayed, they may still get you. That would be the one condition that would concern me as far as using planting date, is that, as I said, if they're late in coming, but 9 years out of 10, you'd expect them to show up. And so, as I said, that is an effective method of especially, you know, once you're in July, because you've already missed the first wave. They're breeding somewhere else. And so that helps a lot.
Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello, Phil.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Mike. What's on your mind?
I've been wondering what the viceroy butterflies, caterpillars look like and what they eat.
They remind me of a bird dropping. You know, they really are very well camouflaged and got white and green, as I said. And so you can see they're trying to mimic a bird dropping. Off the top of my head, though, I don't know what the host plants are. You know, you don't see near as many viceroys as monarchs, which is one of the arguments if you're if you're mimicking a distasteful thing, you don't want to be more plentiful because then it doesn't work as well. But as I said, I'm sure you could easily look that up, you know, viceroy host plants. I know it's more bushes and trees type of thing than herbaceous stuff, but as I said, the larvae are very easily overlooked. I think I've only seen them once or twice in my career.
And thanks, Mike, for calling. I want to give Roger and Wanakee a chance to join us. Roger, hello to you.
Hello, time's running out. I want to circle back to Phil's statement about having a solution to black flies. I need to know what that is. I've been driven off the Missouri River elk hunting because of black flies, been driven out of trout fishing in Richland County Saturday because of black flies. Up in Canada, too, we've been infested. But what aloe solution did your friend from Iowa have?
Yeah, I wish I would have written it down. My friend is from the Cedar Rapids area. He said they sell it locally, you know, and they do get black fly problems in almost any place has got moving water. But as I said, other than I didn't write the name down, I just looked at the active ingredients because I was expecting, you know, what they might have. And I tried a little bit. I know there was vanilla oil there. So you may look, it came in a dark green bottle, probably only about 2 inches long. It wasn't a very big product. But that's worth looking at.
So if you went to Cedar Rapids...
Iowa Black Fly product, as I said, because he talked about it being a local product that they were trying to market a little bit more. And as I said, I've only got one trial myself. It was a short-term trial, but I was very amazed.
Ah.
Now, the other side, being an elk hunter...
Where was your friend from?
Pardon me?
Where is he from?
Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Drive there today.
Yeah, no, it's Cedar Rapids, Iowa, you know, so that's not too far from Dubuque when you get to it. But as I said, I would guess, you know, nowadays with the internet and doing searches, you should be able to come up with the product quite easily. And I've heard about these kind of localized products before, but as I said, this one, at least I had some personal experience with, and we went from day to night. It really was quite interesting.
I've tried a number of things, including citron oil and stuff like citronella, but nothing seemed, you know, the bug spray I used Saturday, they seemed to like it, Phil.
Yeah, no, they definitely respond different than mosquitoes do to some of these products and the like. And, you know, and the other thing that always raises questions is there's multiple species. Do you expect them all to behave quite the same? Probably not, but as I said, this was an interesting product, and I'm often hesitant unless there's some valid testing of some of these things. But my personal test, it was quite interesting, and so again, Elliot's spray was highly coveted by all of us that were canoeing.
I guess so. The only time I found any respite, and this is a secret tool that may work, is as I was wading up one of the tributaries of a trout stream there in Richland County, I went by a large herd of animals, of cows that were lolling in the shade of a tree, trees. And as I approached them, the black flies just left me.
They went to the cows. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's you know, a good 25, 30 species of black flies in the state. There's only 6 species in the United States that bite people. So most of them are more bird feeders, you know, and like. But the problem, they don't bite you, but they still get in your eyes and whatnot. They still cloud around you. So, you know, it's kind of relative. But generally, most of us react much more severely to the bites than we do mosquito bites. And again, the people that talk about big welts on their person that take weeks to go away are not exaggerating.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And just a quick comment. Sandy says the monarch butterflies are back stronger this year compared to last. She's finding lots of eggs on the milkweed. And on that good note, Phil, thank you so much.
So nice to be here.
Phil Pelletieri, he'll be back. We will talk with him again about the world of insects. Always great to have him come by, and we'll look forward to what he's got in store for us, and probably in the month of August would be my guess. In the meantime, you know, we've got lots of good things in store for us here on the Ideas Network. I hope you'll stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.